I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. The Common Ground at Eskenazi Hospital in downtown Indianapolis is an outdoor space designed to create both community and serenity for patients, guests, and the public. The area outside of the entrance to Eskenazi was thoughtfully created by architect David Rubin and his Land Collective Landscape Architecture and Urban Design Studio. Rubin lives in Philadelphia but has offices in Indianapolis. His work focuses on holistic design principles and social sustainability, which put the land and space first, creating an environment that is both nature and people-friendly. Rubin's sincerity and appreciation for art, history, and the land are evident in both the Common Ground area and the Sky Farm located on the roof of Eskenazi. And that's where he and I went first, on a windy afternoon, to learn more about his current and future plans for the hospital campus.
So we're opening the door to the Sky Farm.
Yes. This is an extraordinary space on top of the clinic building of Eskenazi Health Hospital, a space that serves multiple purposes, not the least of which is placing nutritional value in the context of the commissary. 3,000 pounds of produce are generated every year.
And today we have a little bit of the wind, but that kind of almost lends itself to even more of the integration of the nature and the place with all of this.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that is both an aspect of the beauty of it, that there is a breeze up here. It's also one of the challenges. It's been a few years now of trial and tribulation to ensure that the landscape here has the capacity to produce all that it can for the benefit of the citizens of Marion County.
When you come up here, since it's been finished, what kind of feeling do you have?
I come out to the Sky Farm, whether it's a chilly day as it is today in the middle of winter or in the middle of summer when it's verdant and productive, and feel myself enriched by what I see. It's such a unique condition to have this in conjunction with a hospital.
And as we stand at the edge of the Sky Farm and look out over the city and the campus, you have visionary plans for the rest of this campus as well.
Well, aspirationally, we would build upon what has been successful in the context of this great hospital. One of the things that I was charged with when we first came onto the project was to not only offer wellness in the when one enters the clinic building, but to actually inform a campus where healing happens the moment you step onto the property, and to describe an environment where those that are challenged or those who are supporting challenged individuals can feel better about the context of becoming well once more.
After exploring the Sky Farm and taking in the view from the top of the clinical building, we went down to the ground level entrance where Rubin designed the outdoor area called Common Ground.
I knew that identity had to be part of this, the materiality of this place, so the use of limestone, because we're at the southern reaches of the limestone deposits, and that water had to be a part of the healing process.
And so with the healing waters, you have words, you have design, and you have that natural element of water.
In connection with artists such as Mitchell Douglas, a poet, he wrote a poem. I asked if I could take a phrase of that poem, inscribe it into the ground, but place a portion of it within the upwell so that it would appear and disappear subsequently, and that phrase is "the obscured is revealed." And every 30 minutes, those letters etched in the stone capture the water and can be read.
And as we walk around the plaza, there are comfortable benches, there is green space, and there's a lot of design, too.
Yeah, so for me, it was really about giving opportunity for programming, for helpful programming, to give places for people to gather, whether they are as individuals or as groups of people, in every aspect trying to identify a place that is comfortable, that resonates in the heart and the mind as being of this place.
And we see specific trees, we see more of the limestone, and we see plants that are very seasonal. It changes colors and feel out here as well.
Yeah, so the beauty is of any landscape is that it should be designed in such a way that it resonates in every season. The landscape here is slightly depressed, so we're removed from the surrounding street. We're embraced by the falls fountain. In the summer, it's slightly cooler than other areas because of the water, the cooling effect of the water. It's also acoustically separated from the street that surrounds us. Truly a different space. It is fulfilling to see patients down here appreciating the falls fountain or the healing waters fountain or the trellis construct or the gardens themselves, but to have a local kindergarten come with the children to play on the common ground, to have citizens come and participate in wellness exercises of yoga or farmers markets that are focused on locally grown produce. In general, just to have it programmed as such that people will want to be here, that design married with extraordinary programming creates an environment of the common ground.
Ruben continues to develop the Eskenazi campus with everything from green roofs to canine therapy gardens. Each week, we feature a local DIY or do-it-yourself artist who is making it. This week, we meet several young musicians who have found a place to share their talents. Curious Mix contributor Adam Gross takes us there.
All right, you want to start right there?
Yeah. This one?
Rehearsing some songs last minute.
Slip in? Okay, I do.
It's the fourth Friday of the month, and teens and adults are filing in to the Logan Street Sanctuary. Tonight, this arts organization, housed in a World War I era army barracks moved from Ohio to downtown Noblesville, will host the fourth Friday Young Musicians Showcase.
The whole place is kind of freaky here and there, but you know, it has character.
Yeah, it's great.
And when the lights go down, it's just really cool. Mm-hmm. Kind of special.
Before the show, I caught up with the event's founder and Noblesville High School student, Gavin Cooley.
We take young musicians from all around central Indiana, really, and give them a stage to perform their original songs in front of an attentive audience. Today's the first anniversary. I was inspired to start this show because I was starting out with my own performances. I came to what they have here. It's called the Second Saturday Showcase, where they take musicians, again, from around the Midwest in general, and give them a stage to perform on it. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. I want to do that for people my age. And so I came back to Alice and I was like, hey, your Second Saturday Showcase, but for high schoolers. And I guess she just trusted me. All the money at the door, because of the kindness of Logan Street Sanctuary, goes to the performers. So, you know, you get to play your songs and get paid for it, which is everybody's dream, I think.
With people still funneling in, the lights dimmed. And in front of a packed house, the show was underway.
Up first, we have my new band. It's called Skincare Club, and it's with my friend Carson Floyd. It's here for Carson. Woo!
Hello, I'm Carson, and I go to IU Bloomington. But yeah, we have some really good songs for you guys.
My writing process is really fluid. I tried to do the thing where, like, you have, like, a sudden inspiration or, like, a meaning in your song, and that just does not work for me. What I kind of have to do is I sit there with my guitar, and I kind of go into a trance, and I'm, like, staring at, like, some singular point on the wall. and then a song kind of falls out of me. Those songs have so much more meaning than anything I try to write intentionally, but it takes me like 6 months to figure it out.
After a brief intermission, Alec Kosla was up next, playing a mixture of jazz-interpreted covers and originals.
I'm Alec. I go to Ball State. I'm a guitar performance major there.
Go far away, yet you never seize the day. You're all
come. How do you approach writing?
So it's kind of funny. So I'm a jazz studies major at Ball State, So I like to approach things differently, because sometimes I do it from like a music theory, you know, technical standpoint, and sometimes I'll just play and see whatever comes from heart, and just like with chords and melody and everything like that, I just hear something that comes from me when it comes to this stuff. Yeah.
Armed with a ukulele and witty banter, Grace Wiles took the stage to close out the night.
Singing is not my strong suit, but I think I make up for it in audience connection and the jokes I make about my mom. Not bad jokes. Just jokes about how close we are, because we are abnormally close, and I love her very much.
What's your writing process like?
It really differs. Sometimes stuff will just kind of come to me, like Waves, the last song that I played. I originally wrote it as like a rap verse that came to me in the shower. I was like showering, and I was like, and then it came to me, I can't stand when I'm looking out the window, and the hate from yesterday has tripled, and I kind of went into this whole verse, and I wanted to put it with these choruses that came to me separately. I had this idea of like three different choruses that kind of built and wrapped up together in like a very encompassing end chorus. And so I wanted to put those two things together because it was something where the first verse really matched the first chorus of talking about anxiety and how it all kind of washes over you. And then the second verse I wrote because I had the second chorus ready to go. And so at some point I was like, this doesn't really fit because the tempos aren't really right. And so I slowed it down and put a melody over the verse and then made that into my whole song. But other times it's been like, I'll sit down and it just comes out of me. And it's just an entire song right there, which it's kind of nice.
Everything comes like waves on the ocean, waves on the ocean. It's good and bad, it's up and down, it's dangerous and safe on the ocean, safe on the ocean. Everything comes like waves on the ocean, waves on the ocean. It's good and bad, it's up and down, it's dangerous and safe on the ocean, safe on the ocean.
I have a really big announcement since it's the 1 year anniversary of this show. So as some of you know, I'm a senior this year. I'll be off to college next year. And I don't want this show to end. I think it's brought a lot of good into the community. I think it's brought people together. And I think it's more than me now. So next year, Grace Wiles over here is going to take it over.
Announcing that Grace was going to take over the show, it felt really weird. I mean, because I'm super excited, and I know she's going to bring in amazing musicians. But also, like, I've devoted the past year of my life to this, which, I mean, in terms of extracurriculars that I created, like, this is the only thing I've ever done. But I know she'll do a great job, so it felt really comfortable too, I guess.
You guys just announced that you're going to be taking over when Gavin goes to college, right?
Right. He asked me to do that, I think, in November. It was the last time I did a show here, and he was like, hey, just wanted to know if you'd like be willing to do this. And I was like, yeah, of course. I mean, I got stuff, but I can always make room for the Logan Street Sanctuary. I'm a little anxious, but I feel like with Gavin's help and his tutelage, I guess, I'll be able to figure everything out pretty quickly.
For Curious Mix, I'm Adam Gross.
Most people are familiar with the music of singer and composer Graham Nash, but many aren't aware that he is a gifted painter and photographer. In 1990, he created a business called Nash Editions. It was one of the first fine art photographic printmaking houses in the world. In fact, the business's first printer is now on display in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Nash is a busy man, but one afternoon I was able to have a telephone interview with him about his latest album and tour. It was very casual and conversational, and you will hear Nash using the microwave in his New York apartment while we discussed his music and his art and the role that Nash Editions plays in the world of printmaking.
Well, it was the first digital atelier for dealing with photographers. And like you said, it was 1989, 1990 that we opened up our doors. And we make the best prints in the world. I still think so. Even today, I go around places and see what they've got in their Giclée inkjet print world. And I'm very happy with the way that Nash Editions prints are not only selling, but being appreciated.
And I assume you are still painting and taking photographs as well?
I haven't been painting much. My wife, Amy, is the painter in the family, but I have been dealing with my photographs. I have so much photographic work to go through. My discipline on the computer, unfortunately, even though I know what I'm doing, my discipline in terms of creating folders with images in it leaves a lot to be desired. And I have to go down and, you know, get back and straighten it all up.
I know you also have an album again, and you're on tour again with kind of looking back at 50 years of work. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's been a long time, hasn't it?
And I understand that the Over the Years album, you've also included some things that were never released.
Yeah, what happened is that I found out from the web and from personal experience what my fans' 15 favorite songs of mine are. And I wanted to put them on a greatest hits album because there had never been one of my music. Yes, there have been greatest hits of CSN and the Hollies and CSNY, etc., but not of mine. So I put them on there, and then I thought, well, you know, a lot of people have bought these songs, usually several times, you know, in different formats, from cassette to CD and Blu-ray, etc. And what can I do to make it more interesting? So I went back into my archive, and I chose 15 days. People have been responding really nicely to them.
Do you ever get tired of singing those older songs?
Not at all. Would you get tired of singing our songs?
Oh, no. And
there you go.
I'm also guessing that, especially being on tour and working in these smaller, these more intimate venues, they're big venues, but that intimacy with the crowd.
Right. I want my audience to know that I want to be there making music for them. I'm not going to phone it in. I'm not going to do a half-hearted attempt to teach your children. I'm going to sing with as much passion as I can muster and try and get back to the passion with which I wrote those songs. And if I can see my audience on the way out smiling, I know I've done my job.
Well, I also know that this is, and you mentioned that it's been 50 years since your first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album. Any chance of a reunion there?
Not a shot.
You've all kind of moved on and doing your own things now.
Well, we have to like each other to be able to make good music. we have to like each other. We have to be in love with each other. We want to be there to support each other, and it's not there right now, and that's the way it is.
You can find Nash's art, music, and tour information on his website. Just ahead on Curious Mix, Bad.
There's hardly any poetry or limericks that are radio friendly because he's a naughty little scamp.
To the bone.
We always make the fresh beef bone, you know, and then keep it about 5-6 hours to make it.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. The Lilly Library on the IU Bloomington campus is filled with wonders and oddities. Curious Mix contributor Rick Brewer takes us there to hear more about the strange things we will want to see.
When you enter Indiana University Bloomington's Lilly Library, the first thing you'll probably notice is a large glass case housing a New Testament of a Gutenberg Bible. It's the first book to be printed using a printing press.
So what we're seeing is a large open book. It is printed in two columns per page in black letter type. So if you think of like a Gothic font, right? It's very spiky. It's kind of barbed. It looks medieval.
This is Rebecca Bauman, head of public services at the Lilly.
But then it's also decorated by hand with some red and blue initial letters. So at the beginning of a chapter of the Bible, it has, for example, a large sort of fancy letter P in red and blue. It's a very, very beautiful book.
This is perhaps the library's most famous item, which explains its location. But as beautiful and rare as the book may be, it represents a moment in time when our access to information changed forever.
The history of printing is the history of more and more people, of wider and wider circles of society having access to knowledge, to ideas, and so giving them the power to change their own lives and to change their own circumstances.
This Gutenberg Bible is only one of millions of artifacts at the Lilly, as it's home to nearly 500,000 rare books, 8.5 million manuscripts, and hundreds of thousands of special collections. And most of it's never been handled, let alone displayed in glass. And they aren't always rare in the true sense of the word. Some of these things are rare because they're just weird. Like, really weird.
And this is a very unusual thing. So, to describe it, it is basically a metal lozenge that opens up. It's a little case. And it has this curious device in it. It's a smaller piece of metal. It's quite heavy. Has the word electropoise engraved on it in a fancy script. And then it has this long green cord that I'm unwinding right now that attaches to a little metal disc that is attached to an elastic band. So what is this? This is a quack fraudulent medical device that was invented in the 1890s by an entrepreneuring man named Hercules Sanchez. He was sort of a showman, and he, you know, invented, and I put that in air quotes, this device called the electropoise that can be used to cure any, and I do mean any and all, diseases. In actuality, it did nothing.
As nuts as it may be, it wasn't as jarring as the next box they brought out. The box of hair. Human hair.
Everything in this case is hair.
This is Isabel Planton, another public services librarian.
For example, this is a brooch that is completely woven from hair of various members of a family. We don't know much about this piece. It's probably from the Victorian era when this was a popular thing to do. We have another brooch of Edgar Allan Poe's hair that was clipped at the time of his death and sent from a family member to another loved one. And then it's surrounded by pearls. It's a very fancy piece of jewelry. And you have to look closely to see that there is actually a little clipping of hair inside of there.
You might be thinking, why is this in a library? To put it simply, they're a part of a larger collection of papers and manuscripts. They basically came with everything else. Librarians bring these things out every once in a while because things like human ponytails and the electropoise turn heads and encourage researchers to come to the library and explore. And though there's little research value in old hair, if anything, it serves as a reminder that history was lived by real people with real hair and teaches how people used to behave. The Lilly runs several exhibitions each year that usually have a strict theme, but every once in a while they bring out these kinds of items for display, playing on the theme Cabinet of Curiosities.
And that is a term that came about in the late 16th century and really gained popularity in the 18th century. Sometimes they're called Wunderkammer. It's the German term. And even though they're called cabinets, a cabinet of curiosities is not a cupboard. It's an entire room. And a true cabinet of curiosities is really the forerunner of the modern day museum. It is a room full of wonders, full of things that will make you stop and go, wow, what is that? So you would have shelves crammed with biological specimens, you know, stuffed animals, stuffed, you know, preserved plants, rocks. You certainly would have books. You would have artwork. You would have knickknacks, antiquities, things collected from around the world that were curious and strange.
The Lily exemplifies what a library is supposed to do. Help people learn about anything and everything, even the odd, whimsical, and hairy things of the past. For Curious Mix, I'm Rick Brewer.
Anyone can send a card or some flowers to commemorate a birthday or special occasion, but what about a singing telegram? Curious Mix contributor Bob Williams spent part of a holiday listening to and learning more about the Circle City Sound Premier Men's Chorus.
It's Valentine's Day, and I'm in the parking lot of Holy Spirit School on the east side. Below the school sign, it says, "I will sing of your salvation." I don't know about salvation, but I do know there will soon be songs of love. Now I'm headed to the front door, and ahead of me, four men in black tuxedos who will surprise fifth grade math teacher Jessica Black with a Valentine's gift from someone who obviously loves her. You look pretty spiffy.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We clean up good.
Miss Black is handed a rose and asked to take a seat. And then...
Heart of my heart.
It didn't take long for the tears to come.
My darling, I love you.
So, who exactly are these guys, these purveyors of love songs, these barbershop quartetters? Well, it turns out this organization has been around for a very long time. I found out more at their rehearsal.
Derek Baylor. I'm the Vice President of Community Engagement for Circle City Sound.
Our mission is to spread education and singing throughout our community. We utilize that in the barbershop style, which is a unique style that we all enjoy, and we think that others would as well. But really, at the core of it, it's about singing and bringing joy to the community. So our way of doing that is with our voices and through our community engagement. That's what we're trying to do in this singing Valentine's and making them free for the groups that do so much for our community, but yet maybe don't get the thanks they deserve.
So, on this Valentine's Day, over 50 of our city's finest, firefighters, teachers, nurses, hospital workers, all received the gift of a love song. That gift was especially surprising here to Jeff Wood, a training officer at the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Training Academy. When the four tuxedoed men entered the gym, trainees were finishing a punishing round of wind sprints. That's when Officer Wood was approached. Handed a rose.
Oh, thank you.
Let me call you sweetheart. I'm in love with you. Let me that you love me too. Keep the love light glowing in your eyes so true.
call you sweetheart, I'm in love with you. With you.
These guys are really good. For a curious mix with love, this is Bob Williams.
Public art is something most people are familiar with, but public funded art is relatively new. Some sculptors in Franklin, Indiana are giving online fundraising a try. Curious Mix contributor Emily Matheny tells us why.
If you've driven through downtown Franklin in the past few years, you've probably spotted the Sloth, a 14-foot animated mural of the mammal wearing a Hawaiian shirt. It's on the outside of a building that inside houses a workshop where artist Greg Potter and the building's owner, Gordon Strain, are building a new creation. Diane Moneypenny is Gordon's wife. She's also co-founder of the Franklin Department of Public Art, an organization dedicated to increasing the amount of art in the city of Franklin.
And we noticed there was no art in Franklin. There were some war memorials, but there really was this huge hole that we wanted to try to fill. So Gordon started the mural with the Johnson County Community Foundation, and that was a great success. So we were really inspired by that all kicking off in that spark. And so we decided to buy this building and to try to infuse Franklin with more art.
And one of those ways is through murals and sculptures around the city. A bear cub in front of the new Meyer, a mural of girls blowing bubbles on the side of the courthouse annex. And now they are working on a mystery project partially funded by the public for the public. Gordon says using GoFundMe will help raise money for better materials.
I was shocked and surprised at how many people were willing to sort of reach out and give money. But at the same time, I mean, people know our art. Yeah. They know what we do. Yeah. So hopefully they're excited for that. It's been an interesting process, again, because of the size and the unique shape of it. And because it's going to be completely weatherproof. But it also had to be somewhat flexible, just when you see it in person, you'll know why. We did the entire frame, skeleton frame, out of steel, and it's all, you know, welded and holding that way. And then after that, we wanted to cover it with the high-density foam so we could carve and really get the full shape on it. So we sort of, we wrapped the skeleton with cardboard, so we sort of had something that the foam could set on while we poured it. That's where we are now. We're carving the foam. We'll have a few more layers to pour. And then after that, we will cover it with cloth, which will allow us to then weatherproof that whole layer. And then we will apply the final layer, which is going to be fantastic.
And when it comes time to reveal the sculpture,
I mean, we've been joking about it, but it's like, oh, can we take it on tour? You know, it's built that it could hang on a wall, it can hang on a ceiling, it can go on the floor, and it hopefully, I mean, it'll be heavy, but it's not, like, unmanageable. So, you know, if it wants to go on tour, we would take it on tour.
We're trying to figure out, like, how to really give back and say thanks in a really freaking cool way, you know? I don't know.
Break a bottle of champagne over it.
It would take it.
In the meantime, you can celebrate public art by taking a selfie with the Sloth. For Curious Mix, I'm Emily Matheny.
It's time to perk up our palates with a little help from Yelp, the online community of ordinary eaters who know where to find the tastiest places in town, especially when it comes to ethnic eats. If you are craving Vietnamese food, head to Avon, Indiana, to slurp the soup at Pho 36.
My name is Kim, and my business name is Pho 36. The popular dish here is the pho. The pho, they kind of like the rice noodle in the beef soup, and they come with the red beef, and the on the side, the vegetable, you know, the bean rau, cilantro, basil, and jalapeno pepper, and lime. We always make good the fresh beef bone, you know, and then give about 5-6 hours to make it. The best way to enjoy it is, you know, like when it's basically when it's cold weather, you can hear the fall, and now when it's hot weather, you can come with the vermicelli. It's a very, a lot of options.
Pho 36 is located at 9655 East Highway 36 in Avon. Does a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
I was at the library the other day and I found a book by Ethan Coen, of Joel and Ethan Coen fame and fortune. It's called The Drunken Driver Has the Right of Way. And I love this book. There's hardly any poetry or limericks that are radio friendly, because he's a naughty little scamp. But it's a lot of them are funny, and I found a couple, at least one here that I could read, and I find it quite enjoyable. This one reminded me a little bit of Charles Adams or Tim Burton. It's called The Mental Garden. Oh, I love my mental garden. It's so snug and sans souci. I can sit there sipping cocoa till they wheel me in for tea. It's a place where pretty birds chirp, and the afternoon sun shines, and the grill work on the fence is quaintly interlaced with vines. Oh, I love it most right after my electroshock program, when I linger nodding, trying to remember who I am. And I even like the winter, for although the garden's dead, in my mind I can imagine that it's winter time instead. Oh, to find words for its beauty that the mind can comprehend. Oftentimes I try to do so with my nurse for hours on end. In the spring I sit there drooling and I chuckle in the fall. In the summer I sit screaming as I face its southern wall. Oh, it's soothing of an evening as the twilight softly spreads. But it's scary on those days when I forget to take my meds. It's a refuge, it's a haven, it's an Eden, a retreat. It's an Eden, it's a haven, it's a refuge, I repeat. Oh, I love my mental garden, it's so snug and free of care, that I think that I shall stay until they need my mind elsewhere.
Just like taking a little nap with your cocoa in your
garden.
Yes,
we all have our safe place, and this... whoever he is writing for, the space is not so safe anymore. The whole book is just crazy and fun like that, and I recommend this book, The Drunken Driver Has the Right of Way by Ethan Coen. It's a good time.
That's Terry Border. He'll be back again next week with more poetry for the road. Still to come on Curious Mix, sounds.
Inevitably, after performances, people would come up and they would ask me, you know, oh, when were you in Spain? And I would always have to kind of sheepishly say, well, I've never actually been.
And suds.
We'll pull off that sweet wort, ship it through our heat exchanger where we can get it down to room temperature where the yeast likes to work, and send it into our fermenter.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. Making a living in the arts is not easy. Long hours, competition, and low pay can often cause even the most talented and inspired creators to give up their craft or take it elsewhere. In 1998, the Arts Council of Indianapolis and the Lilly Endowment created a grant program to help artists and arts administrators stay engaged. It's called the Creative Renewal Arts Fellowship. Each recipient gets $10,000 to do just that, renew their inner creativity. Curious Mix contributor Sandy Robe introduces us to one of the most recent fellows.
John Alvarado started strumming the guitar in his youth. He studied classical guitar in high school. By college, he learned to appreciate the history and repertoire of the instrument, as well as its connection to the music of Spain and Latin America.
I've studied classical guitar since I was an undergrad and before, and I always knew that classical guitar was heavily influenced by flamenco music. I was always familiar with the Spanish history and tradition within classical guitar, but I had never really had the opportunity to go and experience the culture from where it had really started. The trip had been something I'd always wanted to do in the first place, but I never really had the opportunity to do it.
The Creative Renewal Arts Fellowship helped John achieve that dream.
With my position at IEPOI, I've got the time in the summers to do it, but it's just never really had the funds to do it. It really gave me the chance to financially underwrite the opportunity. So the money primarily paid for the flight, the accommodations. It paid for me to be able to survive while I was there for the couple of weeks. I spent 1 week in Sevilla, where I participated in an intensive week-long study with a flamenco guitarist named Manuel Barquero. Sevilla is considered one of the real birthplace of the art form. I wanted to be able to study with a flamenco guitarist right there in the heart of where it had happened. While I was there, I also took the opportunity to see a number of flamenco performances. I also traveled to Granada, which is a city where there's a lot of history too. Particularly, that's where the Alhambra Castle is. One of my favorite flamenco forms is called the Granadines, which is named for the city of Granada. Before going, I would play Granadines and I would talk about the architecture that was in Granada and the mood, but it was all just things I had read. Inevitably, after performances, people would come up and they would ask me, you know, oh, when were you in Spain? And I would always have to kind of sheepishly say, well, I've never actually been. Getting to be there and really see those things for real, just it made me feel like I could interpret the music more legitimately, really feel like I was speaking from firsthand experience. You know, and I can't say if it changes how the people who hear me play, I can't say if they can tell the difference. I can't say what they're feeling, but I know it feels more real to me when I play it. It feels more meaningful to me when I perform it.
For Curious Mix, I'm Sandy Robe.
Indiana craft beer makers are not just creating unique flavors, they are using more Indiana-grown ingredients. Curious Mix contributor Chris Siegel tells us about the tasty pursuit of hoppiness between Mashcraft Brewing and Indy High Binds.
Okay, so let's start back where the grain is.
That's Andrew Kastner, owner of Mashcraft Brewing. He leads me to the back of the brewery to a row of pallets. Piled up on each pallet are a number of large bags.
So there are four main ingredients to beer.
That's water, hops, yeast, and...
The grain that we choose to use. It could be anything from barley, rice, sorghum, wheat, oats, rye. Can give a nice spicy flavor to a beer. We will actually then run the grain through that mill, and when we crack the interiors, we will then take it through an auger over to our mash tun, where we'll mix it with water in order to start our mashing process.
Andrew takes me over to the mash tun. That's where the starches in the grain are converted to sugars that the yeast will eat during fermentation. The liquid in the mash tun, which is now called the wort, is sent to the kettle. And this is the step I'm excited about. It's time to add the hops.
That's the sound of hops going into to our measuring cup, where we can get ready to dose our beer with those lovely Indiana hops.
The hops they are measuring are from Indy High Binds. Ryan Gedham and his partner Casey Lewis own and operate the hops farm, located on the south side of Indianapolis.
How did you start your relationship with Mashcraft?
Yeah, I think it began with a Facebook ad of them looking for somebody to pick up their spent grain.
Remember the mash tun? Now that the wort has been sent to the kettle, all that's left are the grains, which no longer have their starch, a.k.a. spent grains.
When he, you know, put the post up there looking for someone to take his grain, we responded, yeah, we're an up-and-coming hop farm. We'd love to use it and turn it into compost.
But Indy High Binds didn't just want to make compost from the spent grains.
They came to us and said, would you like to buy some of these hops? And I was like, well, I got to taste them first. Some of those brewers out there can smell a hop leaf in the field and be able to pick up what the flavor elements. That's not me. It needs to go into beer, and then I can be able to pick out what the flavor is. So they gave me a small portion of the hops to be able to play with. We made a beer that we called HIPA, where we use fresh harvest hops directly out of the field and local grain to be able to produce a beer that has that harvest, green, fresh, herbal, fruity character that you get from a fresh hop beer.
Once he realized we were producing a quality, consistent product, he started to use more and more of our hops every year.
Can you explain the name Indy High Bines?
We get a lot of questions about it.
That's KC.
People don't know what a bine is. Hops are bines. They're not vines. So that's kind of sparks conversation. They do grow on an 18-foot trellis, so high bines.
Ryan and KC had a modest start.
Ryan constructed what looked like a giant field goal in his side yard, which I'm still to this day amazed his wife let him do it. And that's where we started our initial trial.
What do you find special about hops?
You know, it's really wild to walk down the rows in, you know, the end of July or beginning of August when, you know, you have 18-foot towers of green plants growing on his trellis, and it's, you know, it's basically, it feels like you're walking through 18-foot tall hallways of greenery.
I have an extreme fear of heights. When we first started working in the platform, 18 feet in the air, leaning over the edge, you know, trying to tie ropes around a wire, it took me a little while to get comfortable. That was probably something I should have told Ryan before, you know, we decided to build a farm based around an 18-foot tall trellis.
Back on solid ground in the Mashcraft Brewery, Andrew tells me about a springtime beer he's making with Indy High Bines. He tells me it's actually the beer they're brewing during the tour. It features a special blend of hops
that a couple of us breweries get to be able to play around with. So from this, we've now on our second year of doing this, How High Creation in the Spring, on April 20th, where we tap a beer that has a really, really diverse and in-depth hop profile of herbal and fruity because of all the different hop varieties that they blend together, and it's able to showcase what those guys are doing and growing hops here in Indiana.
We've reached the final step of the brewing process. After the boil,
we'll pull off that sweet wort from the kettle, ship it through our heat exchanger where we can get it down to room temperature where the yeast likes to work, and send it into our fermenter.
And voila, in about 2 weeks, you've got beer. And no tour would be complete without a taste.
Do you want to try some?
Yeah, I have a little.
Do you like hoppy beers?
Absolutely.
For Curious Mix, I'm Chris Siegel.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to our Curious Mix of stories, but we have one more for you that will require your ears and your eyes.
We're expecting twins in the sky tonight. I'm Matt Pelser, and this is your Weekend Sky Report. In Greek mythology, twins Castor and Pollux were the sons of Leda, a Spartan queen. They were fathered by different men, though. Castor's father was Tyndareus, Leda's husband, king of Sparta. Pollux is the result of the god Zeus seducing Leda, so Pollux is immortal, while Castor is not. When Castor died, his brother Pollux begged Zeus to make him immortal, so he did, by placing them together among the stars, creating the constellation we call Gemini. In the constellation, the heads of Castor and Pollux are named as such. And in reality, Castor and Pollux are, of course, light years away from each other. The brighter Pollux is the closest giant stage star to the Sun, and orbiting it is one of the first exoplanets ever discovered, an enormous planet more than twice the mass of Jupiter, which causes the star to wobble, which is how we discovered it in 2006. And Castor isn't one star, but a remarkable six stars appearing as one. To find Gemini, look to the west and find the familiar Orion. You'll know it by its iconic belt of three bright stars in a row. Then simply look above Orion for two bright stars next to each other. The brighter one on the left is Pollux. It has a slightly orange hue to it. The dimmer one on the right is Castor. The rest of the constellation is even dimmer and forms two stick figures below the two main stars. Gemini will be visible in the western sky in the evening through early June. I'm Matt Pelser. Happy sky watching.
Brandon Meeks composed and performs our music. And this curious mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Matt Pelser,
Bob Williams,
Rick Brewer,
Chris Siegel,
Sandy Robe,
Emily Matheny,
Adam Gross,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.